And we're visiting with Ingo Swann tonight. It's a great pleasure to talk with Ingo again. His new book, Penetration, is a knockout. Let me read from the back cover just a bit here. Ingo Swann, renowned psi researcher, reveals a long-held secret series of experiences with a deep black agency whose apparent charter was simple: UFOs and extraterrestrials on the moon, and worries about ET telepathic mind control powers. The agency was so secret that it had no paper trail and hence no written secrecy agreements, only the verbal ones, which in Ingo's case expired several years ago. Now, you heard him say in the first hour it was 10 years that has passed. Now, in this era of burgeoning UFO glasnost, he tells the story of meetings held in a secret underground facility not far from Washington, D.C., and of being taken to a remote location near the Arctic Circle to witness the expected arrival of a huge UFO over the surface of an Alaskan lake. And boy, when you read it, we read a little bit of that last time, and it's gripping, to say the least. This book discusses undeveloped human telepathy and contrasts it with the probable existence of fully developed alien telepathy, which may have many different forms. Ingo also explores the fact that we officially know far more than we're admitting about the moon, its origins, its atmosphere, its occupants, and many other unusual features. Penetration is about one of the means by which we can learn more about those not of this earth, and vice versa. Telepathy. Do we have the means to answer some very important questions that many have been asking for quite a long time? Inside this book are the answers to some of them. It's a terrific book. The book, again, can be ordered, 1-888-453-4046. Okay, Mr. Swann, you talked about some things more than provocative at the end of that last hour. People on the moon, the end of the Apollo program. People on the moon. What kind of people on the moon? Now, let me jump into my own little line of thought here and mention we've had several guests recently who've talked about anti-gravitic propulsion systems that we allegedly have and developed on our own going back 20, 25 years. Would some of these people on the moon perhaps be us folks going back and forth with technology that is probably the most well-kept secret of them all?
Well, if this is an Earthside project on the moon, I'm really disappointed I'm not part of it. I'd love that. But my estimation is no, I think that I have to go on the data that I can gather up and put together, and to me this means that it's not us Earthsiders who've done this, but ETs, and there's no reason why ETs shouldn't be humanoid like ourselves. After all, these are very wonderful biological body forms and everything like that, in fact. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm not the first to see humanoids. I mean, I did it psychically, but people like when Travis Walton was abducted in 1975, mm-hmm. he reported in his book that there were some small creatures that he first saw when he woke up in this spaceship. And after a while, these seemed to get chased away and were replaced by humanoids, just ordinary people like us, except they were in spacesuits with helmets on. And I don't know why there are humanoids on the moon. I only believe that they're there, not based just completely on my own experience of these things and the way I experience them. But, if you gather together all of the books of people who have been abducted, the great implication is that they're not all these little gray creatures with
sure.
eyes. They're humans.
Sure. The other issue about the moon is we have a historical record going back decades of people seeing lights on the moon,
yes.
Objects, large objects moving across the illuminated surface, or what appears to be that,
yes.
Certainly moving across the lighted surface area of the moon.
Yes.
And all of these things together would certainly paint a much different picture of the moon than we are commonly fed. What's going on up there, Ingo? Is it perhaps, did you have a sense of geological work, mining, development, staging?
Well, I myself didn't have that particularly in my experience of the moon, but others have said that one of the reasons why there would be any interest in the moon is because maybe it's some kind of a space base to begin with, and that there's a lot of geological activity which seems to be going on, which Earthsiders interpret as mining or something like that. I don't have any answers for that, any real answers. And if Fred Steckling, in his wonderful book, We Discovered Alien Bases on the Moon, I mean, he does a really great job. And I think he's now passed away. His book was published in 1981, but I think his son is bringing out an updated version of that book.
Well, that'll be good.
I heard about it this Sunday here. And, you know, it's very difficult to read that book, which is put together so well with multitudes of actual NASA photographs. And he's just pointing out what can be seen in the photographs if you care to look that deeply at them.
And we go back once again to the comment you made about high-resolution photographs.
High-resolution.
There just aren't any around there, folks.
Nope.
And believe me, they exist, but we can't see them. Bill in Portland, Oregon, listening on KOTK, would like to join us and say something or ask a question. Hello, Bill. Listening
on
Hot Talk.
Yes, hello, Jeff.
Go ahead.
And hello, Mr. Swan.
Hello.
And, you know, as I'm listening to this conversation, it's just making me think that hardly a day goes by when I don't think about these gray humanoid creatures you were just referring to and how they are really tricksters. As Carl Jung referred to in his psychology, that they are masters of illusion, in fact. And in the Travis Walton movie, we saw that how they could don these outfits, and they had much more of a humanoid appearance than I think that I've been aware of in any other book or movie. But the question that I had for you, Mr. Swan, was, you know, we do know something, I think, about their physiology, and it would indicate that they do not, in fact, have vocal cords. And we can also observe from the anatomy of their brains that they have these huge forebrains, which, you know, as that corresponds to our physiology, we've got an immense capacity in those frontal lobes, I mean, in terms of being able to forecast the future. I guess what I'm really going to ask you is, do you ever get this thing from a physiological standpoint? When we talk about telepathy, the only models that I've ever come across were something that Andrija Puharic came out with years ago in a book called Beyond Telepathy. He did talk about chemical messengers in the transmitters, the inside and the outside neurotransmitters in the brain. Maybe I could just say something about the work of Candace Pert, who's doing some amazing work in that field.
I read her book last year. It's a wonderful book.
And how we now know that these neuropeptides, which are these chemical messengers that we always thought just resided in the brain, no, in fact, they exist all throughout the body. So, you know, it really, you know, sheds new light on this whole mind-brain.
In fact, it's quite possible that we're not our bodies at all. We are our neuropeptides.
And it also sheds a lot of light on this whole business of thought, feeling, and emotion.
Yeah.
And she does get into that area of that emotions could be of a completely different order of which we have never even suspected what our emotional makeup is and what this emotional body is made of.
There's amongst the areas of suppressed research, there's not very much research that's gone into our emotions, what they consist of. But emotions are telepathic, you know.
Oh, see, yeah.
You can pick up emotions called empathy. They broadcast like mad across space and distance, and maybe even across time, too.
So that's a good word to put on the table. Empathy is really telepathy in your read.
Well, in any transmission of information across that disobeys the physical laws of the universe mm-hmm. can be called telepathy.
So that response we have, empathy, oh, you feel for someone, we are reacting to a telepathic transmission, perhaps in an emotional sense.
Well, the empathy vibrations most commonly experienced by people everywhere on this planet, of course, are sex vibes. I mean, mm-hmm. pick up on these like mad.
Mm-hmm.
And, we're not even talking about behavior or moral characteristic of sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
We're picking up on the blatant fact that people sense other people's sex vibes.
It's probably the prevalent vibration on the planet, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Procreation of the species?
I don't know about that, but, humans use sex for a number of things.
Well, I meant that in I'm trying to speak in a nice, kindly, gracious way, but yes.
That's broadcast. Mm-hmm. There's sex vibe, and then there's hate vibes, and there's love vibes, and
mm-hmm.
creative vibes, and charisma vibes, and things like that.
And sex vibes pretty much lead the pack.
Right.
Okay. Bill, one more comment.
Yeah, just one thing, if I could say. I think one of the areas that we really need to learn from ET about is our spiritual component, and that would be the makeup of us as being light beings. And I think, as you said, we were ignoring those first two chakras, the pineal gland and the pituitary mm-hmm. gland. They play a big part in how we feel and think.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Bill.
All right, tonight.
We're going to pause and return in about 3 minutes with more of Ingo Swann and your calls, too, and we'll give you the number as we come back. And we're back to Ingo Swann. 303 days left until Y2K, folks, for those of you who are counting. We'll be down below 300 days soon. The new Senate report is out, and you can read about that on the website and probably many other publications around the country, either today or tomorrow in the mainstream press. I want to thank Dave Lockman. Thank you, David. He sent me a remarkable URL. Ingo, you may know about this, maybe not. It is actually a complete log, a catalog of reports of observed lunar events or temporary changes on the moon, which has been compiled based on literature covering more than four centuries. Each entry includes a brief description and date of the observation, the name of the observers in question, where these are known, and the reference. The purpose of this catalog is to provide a listing of historical and modern records that may be useful in investigations of possible activity on the moon. This is a very exciting website, and you can go all the way back to 1500.
Yeah. How many entries does he have? Do you know that offhand?
No. There are, 33 different links to click on. Old reports from 1540 to 1689, 18th century reports, 1700 to 1799, 19th century reports, and 20th century reports.
Yeah. Oh, I love it.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
let me see here.
I can get excited over that.
The first one, the year 1540, November 26th, a star-like appearance on the dark side. Observers at Worms.
How did they find the dark side?
You got me. That's what it says here, though.
Oh. I mean, it's probably just in the umbra.
The dark portion.
Yeah.
They call it a side. That was 1540. 1650, a red hill appears.
Yeah.
On the Mons Porphyrites.
Yeah.
That's the year 1650.
Yeah.
1670. Let's see what I'm just hitting these at random. If I could go through.
Be seen by the naked eye, you know, this is a big, big light burst.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
1671. Observer. Now here's a famous name, D. Cassini. Probes and all that. Plutonium space probes and. Fashion designers and small whitish cloud.
Yes.
Seen on the moon.
Yep.
In the year 1671.
Right.
1672, February 3rd, a nebulous appearance.
Yes.
Mr. Cassini was persistent. He kept right at it. In 1673, he saw a large white spot appear on the moon.
Yep. These clouds appear in NASA photographs, too. You can see them.
Isn't this wild?
It's great. I think it's wonderful.
Mr. Bianchini, in 1685, December 10th, observed a reddish streak on a crater floor seen during a lunar eclipse.
Mm-hmm. These are excused away as volcanoes by the conventional scientists.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That's a great piece of work. That's got to be wonderful.
I will give you the URL in just a minute. I'm just sort of having fun dancing through this. The year 1715, May 3rd, Louville and Mr. Halley, famous name there, H-A-L-L-E-Y.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not Halley's Comet, folks. It's Halley's Comet. Lightning observed on the face of the moon.
That's right.
De Louville explained this as storms. Halley reference uses the old-style date here. That's, again,
yep.
1700s. Mind if I do a couple more of these?
No, I think it's great. For people interested in these things, you know, this makes for very good reading because you've really got to wonder what's going on up there with all this stuff going on.
Lightning, again, observed in 1770. And here comes, oh, my. 1783, moving glows around the middle of disk during lunar eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
1783, March, bright points seen during observation. 1783, red spot, fourth magnitude, diameter 3 inches.
Yep.
On the moon.
Yep.
3 inches. That's their guess. Nebulous bright spot of light, 1784. Same thing again, 1785, nebulous bright spot of light. 1786, Mr. Schroeter again for the third time. Extraordinarily bright spot of light. W. Herschel, 1787, 3 bright spots. 1787, again, 3, quote, volcanoes, the brightest. He gives the degrees from the north. The two other further toward the center of the moon, 3 clearly distinct locations. This is the 1700s. 1787, brightest, quote, volcano, even brighter than the others, and at least 3 miles in diameter. This 112 years ago.
Yeah.
Von Brühl in 1787, extraordinarily bright spot, bright spot, bright spot, bright spot.
Yeah, but
a lunar volcano like a 6th magnitude star in 1788.
Yeah, there are no volcanoes on the moon, though.
Of course not.
Yeah.
Let's see here. I'm going to the 19th century now, 1800s. 1820. Luthmer, I'm going to credit the observers here. Brilliant spots in the Mare Imbrium, south of the Sinus Iridum. 1821, luminous appearance on dark side, that's in the shadow we assume, appeared without shadow, bright spot, brilliant flashing spots, plural, bright spot like an 8th magnitude star, 1822, a lunar volcano sighted, 1822, volcanoes on the moon several occasions, again, blinking light, mingling of all kinds of colors, in small spots, in the west and northwest. Isn't this fun?
There should be about 3,000 entries in that catalog if you've got most of them.
There are a lot. This is a great find, and we'll give you the URL as we come back.
Okay.
Visible light, bright spots standing out in the dark gray slate shadow. Small red glowing area noticed on the shadow side of the moon. Glowing line of light right into the dark side. Haze spreading from west end of crater. These are all sightings from the early 1900s. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Talking with Ingo Swann and learning all sorts of things tonight about the history of our moon. That thing up there. I think it's a full moon tonight, appropriately enough, if I'm not mistaken. The URL for this remarkable website is www.mufor.org/tlp/lunar.html. Chronological catalog of reported lunar events from July 1968, and I believe this was a NASA technical report that was logged together in catalog by NASA. As you go through this, and you've looked at many of these before, of course, Ingo.
Right. I think I referred to that NASA report in my book. It was done in 1968.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, that only has 500 and some entries in it, but there's many, many more than that that should have been in there.
Yeah. That's a remarkable item up there, isn't it, that moon?
Yes, and I'm looking today, and it is a full moon. I have an astrology calendar I keep track of things on, and there's lots of planetary squares to the moon and things like that, yeah.
These are all things that we're, again, seeing going back centuries by people, and yet here we are with no high-res photographs of the moon. We're worried about Mars, and it may just be that moon is the Grand Central Station, still extant and operable outside of our atmosphere.
Well, it's certainly easier to get to.
This is the end of side one of the cassette. Please stop the tape, turn the cassette over, and continue with side two.
You said an interesting word there, Mr. Swan. You said astrology.
Yes.
We've had, of course, for a long time, we have Dr. Louis Turi on the program once a month.
Yeah.
Americans consider astrology to be the most important and indispensable part of the daily newspaper, among other things. Not that those particular astrological readings are as good as they might be. I don't know. I don't really follow it, frankly. When Louis is on, though, he does it the same way that Nostradamus did. What is your interaction? How do you interface with astrology?
Well, I started studying astrology very seriously in 1962, and for the next 20 years, I really gave it my wherewithal.
Really?
And this is a matter of influences, and this is an area that really should be really seriously investigated, but it, like developing ESP, it takes a long time to get your wings in this here, in that field.
The idea, of course, being that and astrologists and astrologers call the stars, but in reality they are planets for the most part. They've just used the word stars going back centuries when people looked up and saw them as stars in many cases, but not all. And the idea is that at the moment of birth, is this traditionally correct in your view of it, that we are in an influential mode, and the alignment, geo, electro, however you want to term the influence of the planets, do imprint upon us?
Yes, that seems to be the case. I mean, it's really breathtaking, and one doesn't know quite how that comes about, but certain characteristics go along with certain arrangements of the planets and the fixed stars.
Mm-hmm.
And just really quite mind-boggling once you get enough information. You know, it's one of these things that you can't dabble in and be very superficial about it without getting to be superficial about it. But, you know, the foundation for the study of cycles, for instance, is a very credible type of thing, and they've cataloged various kinds of physical phenomena that go along with certain aspects of the zodiac. And in terms of cycles, you know, growth and decline and so forth and so on. And so there is a whole bigger picture there, which is avoided by our conventional aspects of our societies. I mean, a good astrologer could have a great deal of power, which sometimes they have had, you know, with members of society and things like that. So. And anything that makes power accessible to the unwashed masses is usually made a mess of, so that nobody can really grab onto and do anything with it.
It is diluted, yes.
Yeah.
This is fascinating, and as we have discovered and discussed on this program for years with folks who are pretty adroit in the field, many major corporations, political structures, use astrology on a regular basis.
Sub-rosa basis, too.
Yep.
Oh, yes, I know that for a fact. I know people who have annual contracts with big corporations to put in their 2 bits worth from astrology.
And that's... take out their triple figures worth.
Oh, yes, absolutely. 5 figures.
Wow.
5 figures, actually. Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
There you go. And I like to, from my own perspective, liken astrology to a weather forecast. You can still sure as heck cross the street, but it's nice to know if it's going to be raining and windy or freezing. You can get there. Free will and astrology, Ingo, how does that play out?
They're contradictory, aren't they?
They are.
And I don't know what to say about that. I think actually both exist to a certain degree. My dear friend, the late, great Zella Soufflé, used to say, you know, the motto about astrology is that the planets, the stars suggest but do not compel. But in certain aspects, they do compel, and in certain aspects, free will can figure out how to get around the compelling, I suppose, or something mm-hmm. like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Astrology, like most everything that's really fundamental, has a lot of contradictions attached to it, and aspects that we can't answer from within our limited realities.
It's not to be mocked, not to be laughed at, as many do. It's it may be in its peasant format, perhaps. The good ones. How do we find the good ones, Ingo?
What do you mean?
The good astrologers. Where do we go for credible astrological information, those of us who'd like to learn more about it?
Well, I can't answer that. I've known three, what I consider three great astrologers.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them are dead, and one of them is publishes his newsletter. That's Arthur mm-hmm. Crawford and his financial monthly newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And he's given awards as top timer of the month and the year and the decade and things like that. It's all based on astrology.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, the other type of financial newsletter, people don't like him too much. But, but you know, I mean, if he puts his money where his mouth is, for crime, you know.
Or puts your money where his mouth is
more. I don't invest. I haven't had a very good track record on that myself. I have to admit that. But the first astrologer that I knew, her name was Annie Faley, and she just absolutely wowed me. I mean, this was just tremendous, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right. That is our music, and we're going to take our next break and come back. Callers, thank you for being patient. We'll get to you as we continue. Our new phone number here at Equity Radio Network is 800-850-5043, 850-5043. Be right back. And we are back with Ingo Swann, and his book Penetration, again, is available 1-888-453-4046. That's 888-453-4046. Toll free, 453-4046, Penetration, one of the most remarkable books of the year and recent years, in fact. Cody in Little Rock, listening on the signal, KSYG 103.7. Hi, Cody. Welcome to the program. Your question for Ingo.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show. The question back in, I guess it was the third or fourth grade science class, I was given an explanation as to why, coincidentally or by chance, the rotation of the moon corresponds with its orbit so that we don't see the backside of it. Years later, I began to question that, thinking, what are the odds that we don't, that it doesn't turn?
That there's a perfect sync, yeah.
Yeah, so my question is, what is your input on, is it naturally possible, maybe in the difference of internal density of the moon, that we only see one side, or do you think the orbit and the synchronization is controlled due to, you know, different things that might naturally affect that, such as sun cycles, elliptical orbit, position in relation to the sun and other planets, different gravity forces that would misalign the surface of the moon that we see. How could we always see the same side?
Well, my response to that question is dependent upon the scientific sources that I'm familiar with. And there are a number of theories why the moon doesn't behave like just a natural satellite would. And I don't think there may be a final answer to this question that you've posed, but I don't think there is one. I don't think anybody knows exactly why that happens, why the moon keeps one side always to Earth. And so, based upon the science papers that I've, you know, that's one of the phenomena of the moon that I made an effort to find out what the answer was, and it seems like there isn't an answer yet, so I don't have one either.
Okay.
It shouldn't be. I think there's general agreement that it should revolve on its own axis and present us with all sides, but it doesn't do that, and nobody knows why.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much, Cody.
Thank you.
You bet. In Whispering Springs, North Carolina, is Rich. Welcome to the program, Rich, listening on the Internet tonight.
Right. Hi, Jeff. Hello, Ingo.
Hello.
I was wondering, I read your book here. I was totally fascinated with it. I was wondering if you're doing any current work on either the moon or anything else.
Oh, I dabble every now and then, but basically I'm retired. I'm spending these few years just writing down what I think I've learned from everything that I've been involved with. And, most of the things that I'd be interested in doing are major projects, and I don't have the time or the money to do them myself. And it takes a staff and so forth and so on. And my whole field is always, if I would put my whole interest in a nutshell, it's been the fascination with invisible, intangible forces or influences that have tangible, visible effects. And a great number of things fall into that category, and one of them was psychic perception, psychic phenomena, which really don't have a basis in physicality but do produce physical effects, results.
I wish you would be, I hope you're going to come up and publish some new stuff that you might get into here. It seems like everything on remote viewing is like 10, 15, 20 years old, all the excitement that the books are written about. And there's not much in present-day situations that are could be used as a follow-up for another book.
One of the books that my former literary agent could not market was The Real Story of Remote Viewing, which I was involved in every step of the way from its inception.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm writing that for free. I'm putting chapters in my... I'm publishing a book in my website that's for free. You don't even have to pay money for it.
Yes, I've seen that one.
And I'm up to chapter 55, but it's probably going to be about 500 chapters in this book before it's done, and so it's going to take a while for me to get it all there. But there... based upon my intimate contact with everything that went on with remote viewing from December 1971 until 1988, will be in that narration.
Okay, because all we seem to get now is a lot of sensationalism and the future events that really are kind of far out. And I was wondering about your procedures that you taught there. You have some very specific things, like you have to use colons and black ink on white paper. Is that how you taught it, actually?
I didn't say anything about colons.
Oh.
But, yes, to make a record of what you're doing, it has to be in black ink on white paper, yes.
Hmm.
The ink was necessary. We have to have a record of some kind, and the remote viewer themselves had to make that, and it had to be on white paper, and it had to be standardized, and it had to be in black ink, so that we couldn't be accused of changing it after the fact.
Oh, okay. So there's factors other than psychic as far as these little details.
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
All of the details have nothing to do with the process of being a remote viewer.
Oh.
They were just technical details.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Rich, for calling in. In Santa Barbara, listening on KTMS News Radio 990, is John. Welcome, John.
Evening, Jeff and Mr. Swan.
Hello there.
Hello. I've got three quick questions.
All right.
Two for you and one for Jeff. One is, can you recommend a good book that's in print on the methods of astrology?
Do you have a favorite book on astrology, Ingo?
No, I don't have one book. The good classics from the late 19th century and the early 20th centuries are probably the best to get the bigger picture and many of the details.
Oh, okay.
Alan Leo's basic texts and things like that. And the contemporary astrologers assume that everybody knows every technical detail about astrology, so it passes over the head of even sometimes people like me who know a lot about it. But the early basic texts are probably the best ones.
Alan Leo and some of those others, huh?
Et cetera, yeah.
Okay, and the other one, you know about this remote viewing? I read a book about it quite a while back, and I just was wondering if you'd ever heard of the author. His name was Courtney Brown.
I don't talk about individuals.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Because I just wanted to rate, see if the book was,
Let me answer that. Ingo doesn't have to. That book is not held in very high regard by many people who are in the field.
Oh, okay.
It's an interesting book. Read it as entertainment, and you'll be fine.
Okay, thank you. And the question for you, Jeff, was, that tune that has the guitar in it? What mm-hmm. is that? I just love that.
Well, that's from Philip Glass.
Oh, is it?
His CD is the soundtrack of the film Mishima.
Oh.
M-I-S-H-I-M-A. That's where all the music for the show comes from, that one remarkable CD.
Oh, okay. That's great. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Good night.
Good night. Let's zip up to Portland, listening on KOTK, of course. John, welcome, John.
Thank you, John. Oh, Jeff. I'm sorry about that. Ingor, right?
Ingo,
I'm sorry. I've been having trouble all night trying to pronounce his name. Okay. Ingo, first off, let me ask you a personal question, okay? I just recently broke up with an Aquarian woman because she was so very sociable to the point of almost being a sociopath, like out of sight, out of mind attitude, and I couldn't find any depth of commitment there. I'm an Aries, and I really kind of need a woman who's devoted and loyal, open and honest, and what signs would you suggest?
You are.
Yeah, really. What astrological signs?
John, would you suggest? John. On the 18th, I want you to make a note to call in when Louis is back. Dr. Louis. That's when you got to do this.
Talk about the tail and head of the dragon,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. This is not the venue for that.
Okay. Well, let me ask him his own questions then. The ones that are really relevant to a general
good idea.
Nature. Okay. Major Ed Danes has made a number of predictions.
We
really
don't
dire.
Talk personalities.
I'm sorry.
We do not talk about personalities.
Oh. Okay. Well, there's been a number of remote viewers and psychics who've made some very dire predictions.
There's a man who sits on his feet. Okay.
This year. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm wondering, have you yourself confirmed any of those predictions, such as meteor showers, astrological collision with the Earth, various other things?
In 1993, I published a book called Your Nostradamus Factor. It was published by Fireside, which was a subsidiary of Simon & Schuster. And one half of that book is about learning how to see the future a little bit. And the second half is my predictions from 1993 up through the year 2012 or 10, I can't remember which. And in there, I put what I felt I could foresee based upon all the ways and means I have at hand. And if you would consult that book, you will see that I did not comment on a lot of things of the nature that you've brought up, and I just did not foresee these things.
You don't foresee any problem with even Y2K or Y2K?
Y2K turns out to be a big mess, and I did miss that, and I did not predict that. I predicted economic upsets at various stages, but I can't really say that I spotted you Y2K as a discrete phenomenon.
All right. Well, in point of fact, many people suggest that it may just be a little minor glitch here in the States, but in other parts of the world may be far more substantial. So take that for what it's worth. The book is probably a title that a book search might be required for, unless it's available in some libraries. Your Nostradamus Factor, published by Fireside.
Okay. Ingo one last question for you.
Real quick.
Okay. In your last interview, you told Jeff that you allowed yourself to be blindfolded and taken aboard several means of transportation, cars, aircraft, what else, to a totally unknown destination, where you then did some remote viewing for a fee, and then they brought you back to civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to be honest. When I heard that, I thought, my God, that's got to be one of the most stupid things I've ever heard a human being allow themselves to do, because that's like putting yourself into a hostage situation, because unless you did remote viewing on what was going to happen to you, there would be no way of you knowing those people would not kill you after getting the results of the remote viewing.
That's right. You're right.
This,
but it wasn't the first time, and it wasn't the last time that I did something like that either.
You got it, John. Good point. Thank you very much, John. We have to break now. And it's all in the book, folks, Penetration, The Question of Extraterrestrial and Human Telepathy by Ingo Swann. That's two N's, and the number again is 1-888-453-4046, and we shall continue with Hour 3 in just a few minutes.